Toyer by Gardner McKay. Copyright 1998 by Gardner McKay and performance copyright 1998 by Brilliance Corporation. All rights reserved.
For Madeline. The real crime is not the crime. The real crime is that we turn the page. Never order a margarita in a Chinese restaurant. A Toyer.
Prelude, Los Angeles. The primary color, pearl gray, a whitish blue sky. At night, the purple loom of the city, an all-night dusk. Here the wind never blows, it hardly ever rains. Los Angeles does not look well in the rain. Its stucco houses change color like a runner's sweatshirt. No building is well worn, nothing is burnished. There is no rust. There are no weathered houses, no forgotten graveyards. Los Angeles has no history, no monuments, no statues, no comment. It exists because its water was once stolen from Inyo County to the north. Its land was stolen from the Chumash Indians by the Spanish, then stolen from the Spanish by the Americans. Now the Indians are dead, the Spanish have returned, and Los Angeles is waiting for revenge from the ruined county to the north, a county that no longer has water, which is now dead. It is ripe for retribution.
There is Beverly Hills.
Everything here is new. Cars fresh as eggs. Consortiums built on lunches. Recent clothes designed in ancient cities. Iridescent paintings nearly dry. Wafer-soled shoes that never walk. Stab German accelerators. Bright, snappy credit cards. Young hair. Nothing said yesterday is remembered today. Only the new is trusted, admired. It is all famously temporary. Haunted by ghosts of its late celebrati, those who traded up house to house, some only renting, then died. Roots equals stagnation. Time-worn equals poverty. Realtors equal beau monde. Oranges lie in gutters beside furry tennis balls. There are no poor. The Sunset Strip, a tribute to democratic free enterprise, seen by a cartoonist. Its billboards sell vanities, set in place above the low buildings to divert the sky, the stained air. Outdoor cafes abound close to sealed cars driven in anger. Strollers are intruders. Hollywood. The hills are legally green, a green without death. Dusk colors seen in noon gloaming. Palms in still life, crematorium ash on their fronds. The landscape ages in the manner of a vinyl sofa. The silence is eerie. There are two seasons, day and night. Downtown. Packing crates stand around half opened, a cluster of shiny buildings that will not be allowed to age. Los Angeles is not a city, it is a wide town. A town without a history, it does not want one. It is incomplete, possibly hiding. It is made up of dozens of districts, some with their own city hall, each with its own police precinct, its own complacency, its own anger. It has no memory, no center. It is waiting to become anything. Created by water theft, a done deal. Toyer, he is a masterpiece. A natural response to this neighborhood. He is perfect, the fresh curse. There has never been anything like Toyer. But of course, each time, there never is. Each time, the newest cutting-edge serial lunatic has the same refreshing aspect. He is unimaginable. He has it all. He is a reservoir of all those who have preceded him. Of Ted Bundy, because he has the charisma of a would-be congressman. The Night Stalker as a beautiful Satan. the steadfast hillside strangler with his plodding self-expressionism, the pathetic son of Sam who took orders from a dog's voice, the misguided Zodiac, the expressionless Iceman, Todd. Toyer's domain is Los Angeles, and to the north, the San Fernando Valley, a vast, dry flatland that aspires to be Los Angeles when it grows up. He uses the wide town without opinion, as though he were playing tennis on a court too large, its baselines out of sight. The map of his conquests bewilders police. Investigators connect colored pins, hoping to see pentacles, to discover constellations. He gives them no clue except he is new and he is unimaginable.
The beginning. Lydia Snow Lavin. But the movie was far longer than Lydia wanted it to be. When she stood up, it had been over for her a long time. An endless anecdote. Would the lovers die badly? No, of course they wouldn't. She no longer cared. She'd seen the trailer. Still, she'd stayed on for the final explosion, waiting it out. The FBI agent who'd assigned them to work together knew how much they disliked each other, which meant they'd fall in love. But when they did, Lydia could see that the actors still disliked each other. Horrible kisses. When the lights came up, dimly raising the theater to its fetid grandeur, she noticed that she was nearly alone. Half a dozen couples rose, brushing crumbs. She slipped her movie glasses off, tucked them into her purse. One by one, she clicked off the moments from the trailer. Whoever makes the trailer sure doesn't make the movie. Trailers are so much better. It's always a breathless film and guided by a spiritual baritone who begins, "In a world where..." But you can't return a movie. Return a dress, a steak, wine, but never a movie. It's a blind date from Hollywood in your evening's shop. In protest, she dropped her Diet Pepsi cup with a clack on the cement floor. Six rows down, a man looked over at her, a black-haired man wearing a white shirt, sleeves rolled up a bit, two buttons open. He was with a much shorter girl. He turned away down the aisle and looked back, smiled directly at Lydia and shrugged. About the movie? She intuitively looked down. He could be in sales. He could be in advertising. Lydia's set dream, the care and feeding of a rising professional who drives away to work every morning, smelling of soap, wearing shined shoes. The lush heat of the parking lot surrounded her ears and neck. Used air. She followed the black-haired man and his much shorter date, a couple no longer speaking, as they passed between atmospheres from theater lobby to night to car. But her car would not start. Lydia sat, key turned, pumping the gas pedal. It almost started, but it just would not. And the air conditioner would not work without the motor. She wondered why. She saw her black-haired executive get into a small new car with his midget girlfriend. Now they were arguing. Of course they would. They were so mismatched. Lydia signaled to him, waving. "I'll bet he can start my car, but only the dwarf saw me wave." The rising professional had turned the other way, and they drove off. Lydia tried the starter again. The battery worked. She heard its fierce whine under the hood, determined. The lights came on, the radio played, but the air conditioner would not. Where the hell is Rick? Now she smelled gas. Great, the thing is flooded. Whenever you smell gas, according to Rick, it's flooded. Rick isn't available. If he was, she would not need to call him. He'd be there with her. She telephoned him from the lobby. He had not answered. He's home with his ratty bimbo. She listened again to his male hunter-gatherer message. "I'm out. Your call is important to me. Maybe." She left a message so loud they both could hear it in the bedroom, telling him to go fuck himself. She looked back at the theater, probably built in the 1940s. A shabby temple created to dignify bad movies. Whatever palatial magic it once held was gone. She stayed in her car 10 minutes, as Rick had told her to do, waiting for whatever needed to happen to a flooded motor. Drain, I guess. Lydia stared at the hood. The lights on the theater's marquee snapped off. Now, in the black, she could see the moon faintly reflected on the hood. Once, when she was 6 and plump, she stood up in class and answered that she would love to live on the moon, but what would she eat there? Even her teacher had laughed. "That comes back to me at the strangest times." Lydia got out of the car, looked directly up at the moon, a tough little shard. A wintry moon on a sultry night. Winter up there, maybe. Strangely clear, Jupiter and Orion and Mars. Everything is in order. Life goes on. without Rick. She knocked on the glass door of the theater, rattling it. The staff had slipped away. Only the popcorn machine stood watch, glowing, loaded with kibble for tomorrow's performance. She sat again in the locked car, holding the wheel, with both hands head down, waiting for something to happen. A man, maybe 25 or so, in a dark jacket and white rubber-soled shoes, was using the pay telephone, lit at the corner of the parking lot, leaning on a bronze car the size of an aircraft carrier. One hip out, jeans. She watched him. If he ever gets through talking, I'll call Rick and say I'm sorry. But when he hung up, she waved to him. Excuse me, she called out. Sir? He got into his car and drove over to her. Her hood was up. He'd raised it effortlessly, blindly pressing the release hook with insolent skill. He stood between their cars, slouched, thinking with his face. Good skin. He was about her age, and she could not tell in the overhead light exactly what he looked like, whether he was cute or not. But he seemed uncomplicated, a familiar type. Shy. His jacket had a large orange H on it. I don't know anyone who still wears their letter jacket. He had not turned off his engine, and it churned beside them with the bass grumbling of proud carburetors storming the night. Gleaming wheels, the hood's polished whorls, both ends jacked up an extra foot off the ground. His car's interior looked tidy, and she felt lucky. A shy boy man devoted to cars. Why shouldn't she ask him for help? She'd always gotten along well with simple men, and here was a simple man. She wasn't too complicated herself, she thought. Why shouldn't she get along? Anyway, he wore a letter jacket and called her transmission a tranny, and she thought that was cute. He connected his work light from his battery and hung it under her hood. She gave him a coat hanger from the back seat of her car, and he sculpted it into a long OO and installed it under her hood. She thanked him before he fixed it, as he was fixing it, and when he'd fixed it. She started her car. A classic nice guy. All you hear about are warnings. Driving, even at night, barely seen, the barren main streets of the valley were without redemption. Above the closed stores, on the scathing signs, the merchants pleading, "Sale! Sale!" A visitor to the San Fernando Valley would sense sweeping fear of bankruptcy. Tension lingered along the blocks of dark stores. Sell! Sell! There was no restraint. The number 99 figured in all appeals, a nagging tribute to buyer's mindlessness. In her rearview mirror, Lydia watched his headlights several car lengths behind her. He was driving in the inside lane so his lights would not irritate her. He offered to follow her home to make sure the wire coat hanger held. Now the flat billboard boulevards began to curve, rising gently toward the hills. The valley changed as she drove. The drastic storefronts became firm New England dwellings, Spanish haciendas. Narrow streets named by realtors ending in Dale and Crest and View. They passed Multiview Drive. Now occasional streetlights through the area named Warren Oak Crest, into the hills known to be the Santa Monica Mountains that ran the breadth of the valley to the south. Mounds made of decomposing granite that rose maybe 250 feet. Houses that resembled Lego toys clung to steep miniature lots where no houses belonged, and only animals were able to walk among abrupt inclines. Some were built on air, standing on stilts. Below, the slopes were covered by growths of sage and sumac, already dried by summer, ready to burn. He drove behind her the same measured distance. Good guys, where did they come from? Where are they going? He parked with fierce speed, half a block behind her on the slanted street. He may never finish school, and he's nicer than almost anyone I know at work. The porch light was on, surrounded by flights of moths, who believed they had found the sun. Dimly lit was the small stoop by the front door. Space only for a straight wood bench. The cottage was built in the tradition of appliances never intended to outlast the guarantee. Maybe 50 years ago in the 1940s or the 1950s, no one knew when, but it had lasted. And in the 1960s, a laundry room had been added to the kitchen and later a spindly carport. There were no standard stains of age because there was no real weather, only infectious air. And the small house looked wizened. He stood in the doorway. The lighting in the living room never seemed to matter to Lydia. There was the original ceiling light, exhausted, that gave the room a masculine etch. There were two small lamps bought used, one with an amber shade, the other with a red shade. There was a suite of wicker furniture and a defeated sofa. On the walls were framed posters. The bathroom door was open, displaying dark plastic bottles. Pliers? He opened and closed his hand. School for the deaf. You have pliers, miss? Miss, he's forgotten my name. Yes, I'll get them. Rick left a pair. I'd like to finish the job so you could get to work tomorrow. And a screwdriver, please. And a rag. She found a rag, but no screwdriver, and she handed him an iced teaspoon taken from a cafe. You love cars, right? I guess. When she handed him the spoon, he almost smiled. This is a spoon. She wanted to laugh. It's as close to a screwdriver as you get here. No problem. She saw him now a doer of good deeds, not entirely unattractive to her. Taller, slightly older. But still, he seemed mindless, and she knew she would never be even slightly interested in a mindless man, no matter how good he was. He might lie under cars all day and watch baseball in the evenings and aspire to golf. Like Dad. His bronze aircraft carrier idled down the block by the curb. He switched the great drumbling motor off, leaving the night unstartled. In a moment, delicate sounds of rushing insects joined them. She brought him a cup of coffee. I don't drink coffee, but thank you, miss. Oh, come on in. She had forgotten his name, if she ever knew it. I'm not going to hurt you. She wanted to get him talking, maybe learn a little more about why her car stopped running. And by the time he came to the door again, she was dipping two tea bags into a white china pot, vaporizing. It works, he said, grinning. Great. Everyone else I know is so damn complicated. For all her freedom, Lydia was unfree. Well, I've got to be driving back up to Northridge. Nice guys must live in Northridge. Oh, come on in for a minute. I mean, I wish I could pay you something, but I knew you wouldn't accept it. After all, you rode by me like a knight on horseback and rescued me. He isn't getting the part about the night. I've just made a pot of tea. Hot tea? Yeah, believe it or not, it's good on hot nights. What time is it? He doesn't even have a watch. Everyone has a watch. Well, let's see. What time did the movie start? 8:20? Yeah, so it's got to be... He moved his fingers along his thigh without knowing it, counting. Probably 11:30 or so. I better go. Have a cup. Hot tea's better than iced tea on hot nights. Makes you hotter inside than out. Keeps you from sweating. Oh, yeah? He sat on the sofa with a clump. Good movie, huh? He said. You saw it? He was there? I didn't know you saw it. Yeah, most of it. Cool plane crash. Where was he sitting? I hated it, quite honestly. So did my executive. She handed him the cup and saucer. Did you really believe those two belonged together? Yeah, why not? God, isn't he something? I don't know. Just two movie stars. I mean, love is... She stopped. Too personal. No rules, I guess. No rules? Where did that come from? No, I guess maybe not. No rules in love. Maybe you're right. Maybe anyone belongs with anyone. Was that him in the back row? Someone came in late. He was looking around the room. Nice place you've got here. Well, he's not an architect, anyway. Very quiet. And it gets on my nerves sometimes, frankly. Deep thought. Yeah, I guess. My night, unhorsed, is really boring. He put the cup aside, embarrassed. Hey, I'm sorry, it's too hot for me. It's just as well we have to get up. Who's we? Well, you know, I have a roommate coming home any time. What made me say that? She sleeps right over there, where you're sitting, as a matter of fact. It's a sofa bed. I don't have a roommate coming home, and it's not a sofa bed. Why am I lying? He half rose, sat, stood, maybe embarrassed that she so obviously put a border on the evening. Mom told me never to tell a man you live alone unless you're prepared to spend the night with him. They looked away from each other in silence, listening to the absolute soundlessness of the night. Lydia had not heard a car pass the house for 10 minutes. The gap of silence widened. He had nothing left to say. Neither did she. Lydia? He stopped. There was something wrong. Lydia was too familiar, too sure. He knows my name, after all. The name Lydia hung in the room as though she'd been accused. Your roommate's not coming home. I don't think. He said it simply as if to set the record straight. What do you mean? She's moved. Carol, he added, as if he liked the name. He knows our names. He knows she stayed here last month. I was in here earlier, he said.
But what do you mean?
She was feeling dizzy.
Here?
His eyes scanned the room aimlessly. I cut your phone line. He pointed to the window. Outside. He sat with his arms spread across the back of the sofa. She barely heard him, and when she did, hearing him say it again in her mind, she did not think she really had. She wanted to ask him how he knew Carol's name, but she could not shape the words. Now don't go getting upset. I'm not! The first wave of fear. Oh, dear Christ, what's going on? Be cool. It's just that it's late, and I want some more tea. He reached his untouched cup of tea to her without standing and looked at her with a surprisingly weary look. Have mine, please. Your throat's a little dry, isn't it?
It is dry.
Lydia looked down at her hands, reaching for the cup. They looked small and bleached. He was standing above her. My boyfriend,
Rick.
Jesus. You're not seeing Rick anymore.
Condolences.
What a strange thing was happening to Lydia. I've been picking up your phone messages recently.
No, 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 no.
Could she run out the door, throw herself through the window? She was not sure her legs would work.
Why?
She said it too weakly to be heard. She raised her head, looked up at his waist.
Why me? Why do you want me?
She sat forward on the white wicker chair, her legs bent like spring levers under her, trying to be ready.
He was here earlier. He saw I lived alone. He followed me to the movie. He came back here. He cut my phone line. He went back to the theater. He broke my car. He saw a part of the movie. He was waiting for me in the parking lot. Why did I stay to the end of that stupid movie?
He sat. He stared at her face. Pale, steady, simple. He stared at her sweetly. A suitor come with flowers. And when he spoke kindly. I love you, he said. The words slugged her, plain, everyday greeting card words. She looked at his face for further meaning, for something to come from him that would help her, to tell her, I only wanted you to know that I love you. I'm not going to harm you. I'm really not a lunatic. But he did not say that. She realized her mouth was open. He turned his head to the kitchen for an instant. Push up. Jump, run, 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 door. She was on her feet, running to the front door. Door, 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 please be open, reaching for the knob. He was there, waiting for her, between her and the door, waiting. She hadn't even heard him move.
He's liquid.
He walked her back to the chair, holding the cord of her neck locked between his thumb and index finger. If she hesitated, the pain became abrupt.
Don't, please, he whispered.
His voice tired, but still kind. An apology was there. I'm just so quick. Then, with a helpless respect for something he could not control, got him quick. As though he possessed some sort of terrible excellence, he barely understood.
Don't be afraid, Lydia.
She was, very. She began to hear a wide hollowness echo in her ears, then a busy clamor of voices that she had to speak above to be heard. I'm not afraid of you. Her voice drifted away toward the ceiling, lighter than the thick air.
What if he really does love me? If he does, he won't hurt me. He's not going to rape me, is he? Rapists are violent. And he's so shy and quiet. I've got to let him know. Tell him that it'll be okay if that's what he wants. I'll give it to him. He's cute. I don't want him to rape me. He won't have to. He has to know what I'll do, or he'll be scared and hurt me. His fingers are too strong.
Lydia was giving way, feeling younger than she had since school, knowing that what was happening now was going to be over soon, that it would come out all right, that Rick would realize his mistake and feel remorse and come looking for her and burst through the door at any second.
But there is no Rick anymore. I told him to go fuck himself, and everyone else is asleep, and I'm alone in the world.
He came over to her. He did not touch her. He stood. He seemed to drift in the room.
He won't ever leave until he gets what he wants.
What do you want me to do?
Don't cry.
I won't.
I want it to be over. I want it to be an hour from now. I want it to be tomorrow morning.
You don't know what's happening, do you?
Lydia stopped breathing. Can you please tell me what you want? Can hear my body trembling.
Don't you know who I am?
Please, no.
You must have heard of me.
He spoke so quietly. This is him.
Have you? Do you have any idea how famous I am? She no longer could feel her face. She had the impression that her insides were not there anymore and that the rest of her was falling a long way down in front of her.
6 years old, caught. coat pockets in the locker room, hairpin, silver coins. Thief! Waiting for the principal. Down in the big sticky chair, my panties stuck to the leather. Phone call to Mom. The electric clock. 10:10. Snow. Everyone in school knows. Dismissed. Sent home. Punishment. Everyone on Earth knows. Thief! For a few moments, Liddy did not know how long she drifted away above the room with the stupid swap meet lamps. She always hated and watched the two of them from an enlightened place. He was talking, she was listening. She heard the word moon once, and then again. She vaguely realized that he had stopped talking and was staring at her, waiting for something, maybe for her to speak. He had said something about the moon, and it came back to her, the way church bells come back to you in your sleep, and you know exactly what time it is. The night is the memory of night. No one knows the night anymore. No one looks at the sky. No one knows what to look for. Light is too important, was what he'd said. Have you ever looked at the moon? Oh, yes, of course. I love the moon. What does he mean? I used to want to live there. He's a lunatic. Dead is the moon. The saddest words I've ever heard. He was staring at her, imploring her. The moon is dead, but she goes on being beautiful, doesn't she? Rising and setting and so on. This is what he looks like. Toyer. I've read every word they've written about him. Everyone has. The women are always drugged. Am I drugged? He nodded once. The tea, yes. Just think, you won't see tomorrow, and I will. Beyond the room, the valley slept. Across a vast basin, the twitching of edgy televisions lit its ceilings. Please rape me. Do it to me, but don't do the other thing. He sat forward, concerned. What were you going to do tomorrow? I'm going to run through the window. It'll cut me. I'll cover my face. Now. Through the window. Out! Her legs straightened and she leapt toward the window. He caught her arm. She fell against him and jerked herself back, swung her fists at him, but she did not feel him hitting him. She was screaming, or thought she was screaming. Maybe she hit him a dozen times. She tried to bite him. She stopped. Empty, she lowered herself without muscle back into the white wicker armchair. She remembered the decorative pattern of the protective bars outside the window. There never any goddamn open windows in a woman's house. He stood above her, breathing evenly. Don't scream again. The way he said it, bone dry without apology, was different from anything else he had said. He prompted her as though he needed to know her plans. What were you going to do tomorrow? Work. Lunch with a girlfriend. Who? Katrina. Why does he want to know her name? She's Swedish. She's getting married. Cash my paycheck, pay for a dress. She pulled the pillow around from behind and pressed it into her face, smothering herself so she could bite into it, jolted by her sobs, sobbing helplessly now without strength, without knowing where she was. A step out from the world where she was standing, almost falling free, almost falling dead. Her world remembered as a place she once knew, a place she could not imagine how she got to or why she was leaving. He seemed disappointed in her, as though he'd relied on her and she'd let him down. Good faces cannot be measured, pretty comely faces. In Lydia's, there was an imbalance between the alertness of her eyes, a lightness, a playful maliciousness, and the spread of her mouth, a serious, grave mouth. Her eyes somehow, even now, seemed optimistic, her mouth dark with fear, as if she deserved grief. This is what dead is like, but he won't kill me. He never does. All those girls living on wheels, wheeled around, who'll wheel me around. I'll be in Pennsylvania with my folks again. They'll look after me. They'll read to me. I'll watch television. Yeah. People will love me. It'll make them sad about me. They love victims. I'll be able to see it in their faces. Thank God I've got a big family. He was speaking. I may never stop. So poised. But then I may, if something goes wrong. I think they'll take good care of me. They'll give me their very best. This is Toyer telling me about Toyer's agenda. Listen to me. She could not hear her. Sound was rushing past her ears. She felt him touch her shoulder and jerked away with a pillow held tight to her face, as if it alone would keep her safe. Listen to me. Can you hear me? I've got a present for you. You're going to do all those things tomorrow. You're going to be all right. Lydia peered at him above the pillow. He was standing in the middle of the room. He was smiling. I live down the street. I see you drive by every day. I just followed you to the movies. He talked to Lydia as if he were talking to a parakeet. Say it again. It's all right. Please, I didn't mean for it to go all the way. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to scare you. What? Now he brought his hands from behind his head and leaned close to her face. He waited until her eyes opened. He was so close that his face blurred into a single owl's eye. He said in an easy, trained voice, "I'm an actor." He spoke with such ease, such trueness, he might have been royalty handing her his crested calling card.
"An actor? God, I hate actors." "Well, an unemployed actor."
He pulled a black comb from his back pocket. "I've not a good part since I came to this town." He took a moment. "Except this, I was playing a part, understand? I just wanted to make some total stranger believe me. I tried to build a character, and when I think it's there..." He interrupted himself to comb his hair. "Then I sort of cut it down a bit, try to make it work." She could see he was enjoying the moment, that it had worked for him. He smiled and stood, filled a glass of water, drank. He was smiling for himself and standing for effect. She watched him carefully, not his face, but his arms and shoulders, which were a pleasing blur. He opened the front door and gathered in some air, closed it before the mosquitoes found out. She had thought of him as her age, but now he seemed less than her age. He had slung his letterman's jacket under the back of the sofa. From its pocket he was bringing out two pages, staple-folded twice and quartered, marked notes. The scene that had just played out had been in his back pocket all evening. He smoothed it flat on the coffee table between them, and on the top it said, "Toyer," and then two characters, as if it were a play. Lydia's eyes came stinging back to her, and she covered her face again and felt herself slip away. So held her temples and forced her eyes away from him to the poster of an overdressed 1900s woman on a bicycle holding a protest sign. "Mind if I get myself a drink?" She did not answer. He had just finished one. When he came back from the kitchen, he handed her a glass of ice water. When she took her hands down from her temples, they shook. What do you mean you made it up? Why would you want to do that?" "Don't call them crazy. They don't like to be called crazy." "They are. He probably is." But she did not care. What she did care about was the difference between who he said he was and who he was, and what time he was leaving. "Why would you pretend?" But she could not say the word "toyer." "It's important to me, to my development, to invent a character and make someone believe my character." His easy voice sickened her. "Would you stop talking, please? Thanks. Anyway, life looks good again. I've been feeling sorry for myself about losing Rick. If I can't do better than Rick, I deserve to die, but what a way to find out." Suddenly she remembered that her parents were not going to see her picture in the newspaper, and she laughed. "I can't figure why anyone would want to do what you just did. I don't even know who you are." And he laughed nicely for the first time all evening. "Well, I don't know who you are either." "Sure you do." "No, I don't. What's your name?" "I told you. Lydia." "No, your last name." He stood framed in the doorway. "You really don't know?" "I really don't know, I swear." "Well, you never will know it." "I'll never tell you. Leave it at that. I'm just curious. How did you know Carol doesn't live here?" "Oh, when I was fixing the car, I saw her name scratched off your mailbox. Carol, he looked like Miller." "Yeah." "What about Rick?" "I know Rick." "He never mentioned you." "Just kidding. I heard you tell him to go stuff himself. I was standing right there listening by the restrooms."
"Am I drugged?"
"No, no," he smiled. "Tell people they're drugged and they feel drugged."
"But I do feel drugged."
"Just go." I'm going. But for your own peace of mind, I want to show you I'm an actor and a neighbor. My idea's in my car, that's all. Excuse me." He opened the door and slipped out, closed it. He was gone. And the door opened, and he leaned inside again. "You forgot about your phone. I told you I cut your phone line, remember? Try it, see if it works." He was gone again, clomping down the three wood steps, a late night, stirring of air, turned the paper flower hung from the ceiling by a thread, first one way, then the other. Lydia glanced at the telephone, the darkest object in the room. Why did I get a black phone? It had its own swap meet table, an eccentric telephone table from the 20s. She stared at it. "I'm sure it works. Why should I let him see me trying it? That means I'm still scared." Seconds passed. "But I've got to." She crossed the room quickly and yanked the telephone to her ear. Waiting for the dial tone, the wide hollowness rang again in her ear. Dead. Her fingers flashed down, jamming the receiver. 1, 2, 3, 4, dead. 1, 2, 3, 4, dead. Dead, 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 dead. As the moon. She stared at the telephone until it blurred. Her insides were slipping away from her. "He's watching me from the doorway." She didn't turn, holding the moment. "I know he's standing there." She turned. He was. Just inside the door, smiling, head canted. Caught boy smile, lips pressed together. He nodded once, twice. "Sweet. Sorry." Something shiny she could not quite see, an icicle held just behind his leg. He spoke, so quietly she could barely hear him. She watched his lips move, felt the third wave of sleep, deeper than the other waves crashing ashore in her drugged night, felt her legs leaving her, being drawn away from her in the waves undertow, being drawn out to sea. "I love you," he said. Maud Garrett's Night. A small house in a canyon above Los Angeles, a woman enters. Her name is Maud Garrett's. She's 36 years old. Tonight her skin is papery, her face complicated by woven scars of fatigue. They highlight her eyes, smart eyes cowled by pain of the ordeal at the hospital that's been going on now for nearly a year. Nurses who follow her on rounds watch her carefully, worry about her, regard her as a mythical creature, some imitator. She regards most of them as unskilled. Maud Garrett's lives alone now in this rented house that was never air-conditioned. Maybe if she owned it, it would be. But these airless nights are rare up on Tiger Tail Road. And tonight, the day's heat clings to the arms of the trees, the walls of her room. For maybe 1 month each year, sweat heat rises through the Los Angeles basin below. We're miles away downtown. Lamppost lights shine in Silver Lake Park. Families too hot to stay home sit on benches, waiting for the night to cool the pavements. It is April 30. A hot night, too soon, even in the canyons above Los Angeles. It is nearly 10. The telephone answering machine blinks once. One call. She switches it on, listens to the soft silence of the telephone static. A male voice at her descant, without irony, calm, paternal.
"You needn't be upset at yourself or me, Maud. We none of us are perfect. We just don't know why these things are happening. They are, that's all."
"Yep," she says. "They certainly are, Dr. T." She can see him telephoning. He sits in an office chair a size too small for him, his polished brogan side by side. He wears grainy tweeds and earth tones, looks as if he dressed in health foods. The chief of service at the Kipnis, clumsy, loyal, in love with Maud, still unexpressed.
"Our task has always been to cure, hasn't it?"
"Yep," says Maud to the taped voice. "Best to my knowledge." She stands, steps around the counter of the kitchen, and sets a kettle on the stove.
"If not to cure, to help. We're on the sidelines. The damage is simply irreversible."
"Yep."
"Your task is now to prepare them for their new lives. They're many years ahead."
"But they're too young."
"But please don't let anger blur your vision."
She hears him taking a breath.
"I'm sorry this is happening to you, but you know you can take a leave at any time."
"If the strain becomes too much." The tape turns in silence.
"Please come by before rounds. You can find me on 6. Good night, Maud. Get some sleep."
Dial tone. He is not able to tell Maud that he loves her. She drops her skirt around her ankles, unbuttons her silk blouse. Maud has come home defeated. She is losing Karen Beck after a month of therapy. Karen, her patient, will remain on Earth as a pale flower, a pretty pale flower, forever. She pulls a metal loop and rolls back the top of a small can marked Feline Feasts, causing a pale ginger cat to appear from the windowsill behind a curtain. It is Jimmy G. A creak, not of a cricket, outside the window behind the sofa, a small human sound, a scrape in the bushes. Maud stands in her underpants and green silk blouse without moving. She listens to the white hum of the city come up through the canyons miles away. She listens to the black hillside. Silence. The faraway yelp of a young dog or maybe a coyote. Jimmy G's right ear twitches, nettled. He's afraid of coyotes, their strange cries. Maud opens the refrigerator, squats easily, takes 3 ice cubes in her palm, crosses the room, and pushes the play button on her CD player. Sits in her chair, legs wide. She cools herself, moving the ice cubes on her neck, arms and shoulders, between her knees, wherever her body requires it, feeling the melt cross her limbs. Jimmy G flattens on his side, just below her fingers. The disc spins. The male voices sing far too loudly. She makes no move to turn them down. She absorbs it. Their strength reaffirms something she needs to hear. The Pearl Fishers duet between 2 brothers in love with the same woman, both trying to decide the right thing to do, which turns out to be abandon her. Stupid.
Maud settles and submits, trying to let the music enter her, and her the music. Before the duet ends, she is asleep. The beep, 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 beep shock of the beeper wakes Jimmy Chee beside her, who raises his head and watches her reach the telephone and tap in the hospital's numbers. His Chinese eyes nearly closed, he lowers his ruff down onto his paw. Ed Tredescant comes on the phone.
Me again.
Yes, Elias. Maud is the only one who calls him by his middle name.
Maud, it kills me to ask you, but could you get back down here again?
Not a fair question. What can I do for you tonight, Elias? She knows before he tells her.
An invalid, Maud, just in.
He uses the word invalid only when he describes her patients, the victims. How old is she, Elias? She does not know why she asks.
Young. I don't know, Maud.
What do you think? Is there hope for her? They've had this conversation before. He pauses.
I'm not sure, Doctor.
He calls me Doctor when he needs me. Stop anyone from testing her till I get down there. Dr. Tredescant is also careful never to mention the name Toyer to Maud. Neither he or any of her nurses. It is absolutely forbidden. They remember her fury when she examined her first patient, Virginia Sapin. A nurse, Cleo, called Maud borderline, not to her face. What's her name, Elias? She hears him turn a page while he looks.
Lydia Snow Lavin.
Ask Cleo to prep her for an MRI. I'll leave in 5 minutes. Tonight, Toyer's ninth. Maud's ninth. Lydia. The Kipnis Memorial Neurological Center for Advanced Research, seen as an ocean liner at anchor under a lover's moon. Maud drives up an incline and to a stop in the painted rectangle marked Garance. Most of her floor lights are out. The Kipnis above Malibu, set on its own 12 acres among low hills, overlooks the Pacific Ocean from an earthquake-free eminence. Maud can see Dr. Tredescant waiting just inside the air-conditioned emergency entrance. He's holding two paper cups of black coffee, one for her. Drainage from the gutters of abattoirs. There are five in motion walking toward the elevators. The drill is familiar. Maud is followed by a small swarm of respect. Maud is a known victim, a recent widow. A new nurse says, "Serum sodium is off the chart, doctor." Maud nods, "Of course." "It'll take a full 10 days to bring it up," Nurse Cleo says. "She's got the 10 days, Cleo," Maud says. "She's got 10,000 days. A thin woman Maud has never seen says, "I can't find her medical." "No cart?" "Nothing. Do I put her on the crime fund?" Maud is thrown for a moment. Billing's not her concern. "Well, if she can't pay, she'd have to be an heiress to afford this one." Dr. Tredescant says, "Go ahead, Andrea, bill the police for the time being." Everyone nods slightly, "Just so." The woman concerned with billing drops away. Maud says, "Have you monitored her breathing?" "Yes, well, it's clustered," Cleo says. "Yeah, it would be." Lydia Snow Lavin lies under a large hospital tunic, another pale, pretty flower. A skin-toned bandage is centered across the nape of her neck. White gauze covers abrasions on two of her fingers. Maybe she's fallen or fought. Three people in white watch her without speaking. Dr. T, Maud, the new nurse, new enough to be aghast, Maria. Maud, "Is she drugged?" "As before," Ed says. "It is xylazine, the wild animal tranquilizer." "She looks stable," she is. "Yes, when..." "Almost 5 hours ago." Maud nods blankly. Dr. Soon from the city has just joined them and stands against the wall. "Bring me the disc, please, nurse," Maud says. The new nurse stands, immobile. "Nurse, the disc, please." The nurse nods yes and goes. "Let's begin the test," Maud says at the floor, no longer regarding the patient. "Give me the ice water caloric." Cleo moves. She adds, "I want some blood." Dr. Tredescant says, I want an AIDS test, Elias." "Why?" "Why not? This is a sociopath. Maybe he wants to share." "Is there proof of sex?" "Assume there is. Blood? Okay. Thank you." Cleo goes. Maud runs smelling salts under the patient's nose. Again, nothing. She whips out a tiny flashlight, rolls up an eyelid on a stick, probes her pupils for response. Nothing. Maria, the new nurse, comes back with a small CD player. Maud sets it by Lydia, turns it on. A female voice is singing. "Ready for the calorics, doctor?" Lydia Snow Lavin has the unblemished face of a 12-year-old girl. Pale skin, pale hair, light eyebrowed. Lovely. Straw fields in the sun. Eyes are pale and show absolutely no response to the music. Apparently, she has been spinally cordotomized. Cleo turns her head on the pillow, surrounds it with a towel. From a syringe, she squirts
Small shots of ice water into her ear. Lydia's eyes reveal nothing. That's it, Cleo. Cleo wipes Lydia's cheek, straightens her head on the pillow, closes her eyes. Maud stares at the new patient. She stands absolutely still, moments too long. She feels sick. Her stomach is turned upside down. This happened with the last patient. She feels her fiber starting to give way and cannot show it. Dr. Tedeschant reaches his hand out and touches her shoulder. Never mind, Maud says. Forget the test. Nurse Maria folds her arms, looks away at nothing. Want me to set up the tangent screen? Cleo says. Maud shakes her head no. You want a Glasgow coma scale? Set her up for an angiography in 5 minutes. In the furthest silence, Lydia Snow Laven sees white lines, now whiter, gradually forming, clouded perimeter. A blurred too-white room, figures moving in cloud banks, unfamiliar, altered voices, vague forms dressed in white, shifting in jolts, untouchable reality. New bright sounds, nonsense sounds jumble. Space is silent again. A female voice is singing. Lone white gown form remains. Cool. Water falling, dashed on rocks. Purling downstream. Womanly. The shepherd song from the Auvergne, a Basque folk aria. The superb beauty of the rich soprano voice, supremely feminine. As soon as possible, Maud will obtain the actual discs and tapes that Lydia last listened to in her car and at home. Eyes, hair, face. A woman's face. Pale, close, young-eyed. Materializes out of the blinding white light, gradually forming exact features. Lean, short-haired, attractive. 30s, no nonsense. Maud is close, looking for light in Lydia's eyes. A sign. She moves a vase. Simple flowers, good flowers. Pale blue and lavender wildflowers, thin stalks. Will she regain basic functions, doctor? Maria, the new nurse, has re-entered. Maud does not answer her. At this stage, she believes that there exists the possibility of reclaiming some neurological loss. The soprano voice twists into scales of intense notes, close to screams. The new nurse's eyes widen. She looks irritated. Lydia's remain fixed. The soprano continues singing the shepherd's airs. Maud whispers to Lydia, to herself, please, oh, please, Lydia, please, try, try, you've got to try. We'll try together. Blurred words. Maud calmly pleads for response, looks closely, eye to eye. The black fog bank rolls toward Lydia and enshrouds her. No one is closer to these unique victims than Maud Garens is. She's the first doctor called in to examine each victim and make their preliminary prognosis. That is, to discover if there is a telling light in their eyes that might indicate the possibility of partial recovery. She is a physiatrist. It was accidental from the start when the first victim of Toyer was admitted to the Kipnis for a series of tests under the direct supervision of Maud Garens. It was to determine whether rehabilitation was possible, and as always, the hope of the police is that the victim may be made well enough to reveal a description of her destructor. Maud sits for a long time staring at Lydia. Nothing. The singing shepherdess does not register in her dead eyes. In Lydia, Maud sees a perfect universe of atoms and molecules rushing together without hope. Like ours, she thinks, but in perfect asymmetry. She will try again tomorrow. She cuts off the air with a tough snap, sending the CD player and disc clattering to the floor. The new nurse scrambles to gather up the rolling batteries. Embarrassment, helplessness, irrational behavior. She's just broken the CD player. Is Dr. T troubled by the imbalance? Maud looks away to the night black window, contains her fury. She picks up the clipboard, marks her comment and the time, hands it to the nurse, and exits.
This is the end of side one. This program is continued on side two of this cassette.